Okay, we're going to get going because we have a very full, wonderful program and panel later. I'm Janet Wilson with the Desert Sun and USA Today Network. We write a weekly climate and energy newsletter for USA Today also. And I am lucky to have a wonderful co-moderator today also. It's Daniel Ackerman. He's an independent journalist who's covered a lot of these issues as well. And just to make sure you're all in the right place, this is the Hunt for Critical Minerals panel. So welcome, everyone. So we've got about 9 years, scientists tell us, to slow global warming enough to have some semblance of Earth left as we know it. And world leaders seem to have woken up to that fact. And rather than regulatory measures, though, like mandatory slashing of carbon or even carbon taxes, they're kind of going with a lot of market-based approaches, and one of those is transitioning to renewables, big time. So as part of that, everything's complicated, right? So renewables, no emissions, but you need a lot of critical minerals to make the batteries in every single one of these work, to make the batteries in our electric vehicles work, and we're going to need at least a billion, possibly more likely close to 1.5 or 2 billion EVs before we're all done. And then the large commercialized battery arrays that they're starting to build out in the California desert near me that are going to store the wind and solar, they also need lithium, manganese, cobalt, other minerals. So there are the traditional ways of doing hard rock mining. It started in Nevada, got it going on in Australia, and in South America. And there are also vast open salt evaporation ponds. These two have environmental downsides. So there are emerging technologies for new alternatives, and we're here today to talk about two of those emerging technologies and to discuss with a great panel whether they offer advantages and how far along they are. So we're going to kick it off with lithium and other minerals that could be not mined but extracted from a vast deep underground reserve in the California desert, basically at the hot, dusty southern end of California, far from the coastlines. They're 1 to 2 miles underground. There's a huge boiling reserve of brine. And in that brine is one of North America's largest, if not the largest, concentrations of lithium, and it turns out manganese and some other minerals. So we've got two great speakers here today who are going to talk to us about that. Sam Moore is at our far left. He is the Chief Commercial Officer for Energy Source, which is one of three companies that's pushing really hard to extract this lithium. And their company is actually the furthest along, so I'm excited to hear how it's going. And then Christian Torres is the Special Projects Manager with Comité Cívico del Valle, which is, I'm probably mangling the pronunciation of that, I apologize. But they are a leading, not just regional, but California public health and environmental justice group. And they've really been involved from the ground floor on extraction of lithium and related community involvement and issues. So, without further ado, oh, very quickly, run of show. So they're each going to speak briefly. I'll hand the reins over to my most excellent co-moderator to introduce our deep ocean mining speakers after we finish the lithium portion. We'll have a little bit of moderator-led questions and discussion after they each give their presentations, and then we'll turn it over to the audience in time for plenty of questions. Priority goes to SEJ members and journalists, and please state your name and affiliation when you ask a question, and then we have been told very firmly by the conference organizers, get to the ballroom by noon. So we've got an hour and 45 minutes to figure all this out. So welcome and thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Sam Moore first.
Thanks, Jenna. Is that working? Hello, can you hear me? Look, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and share a little bit of what Energy Source Minerals, or ESM as we call it, is doing. Obviously sharing with the world what we do is one of the more fun parts of my job. And it's also a very exciting time to be on a panel like this. I mean, as Jen has said, I don't think I need to tell this particular audience the urgency and the need for decarbonisation that has been established. And also, the electrification of transport is now well underway. So ultimately, you know, the need has been established, but the success will depend on finding new sources of critical minerals and metals. The transition will be a challenge. The scale of the need is enormous. We live in a time where, quite rightly, we pay much greater scrutiny to how we exploit natural resources. And we also live in a time where countries are starting to take much more care, or pay much more attention to their supply chain. And you know, the desire or call for local supply chains is becoming another factor in how the world responds to the need for especially EV minerals and metals. So what is clear is that we won't succeed if we keep doing things the way that they've been done in the past. Taking lithium as one example, a couple of years ago, demand might have been around 500,000 tonnes per annum. That needs to scale by at least 10 times into the future to 5 million tonnes per annum. And you know, some would say more, and some would say a little less, but the challenge in that exercise is not to be underestimated. The challenge in the US is even greater, where there is no real supply of domestic lithium at the moment. There are some, but not meaningful. And with the desire for local supply chains, the US is almost having to start from the standing start, whereas others have a much longer history in producing the material. So as you can imagine, it's an exciting time, and it's a privilege to be working with a company pioneering new technologies to access lithium in a way which we think is much more efficient, much more effective, and also much more sustainable and environmentally friendly than has been done before. As Janet said, the predominant technology today is open cast mining or large evaporation ponds, and both have obvious environmental impacts, whether it's carbon, water use, and certainly land footprint. We're changing that. ESM has developed a new technology for extracting lithium from brine resources. This can be deployed across the world and obviously in the US. It is vastly more environmentally friendly, will be more effective. It doubles the recovery rates for brine lithium over traditional evaporation ponds. I'll talk a little bit about the platform itself. It gets a little bit technical, and full disclaimer, I'm not an engineer, so I won't be getting into too much detail, and then I'll talk a little bit about the project in the Salton Sea. We call our platform ILiAD, for Integrated Lithium Adsorption Desorption. It sits within a class of technologies generally known as direct lithium extraction. And it uses a fraction of the water than would otherwise be used for traditional extraction. It emits less carbon and obviously has a much, much smaller footprint. Within the world of DLE, direct lithium extraction, we also think ILiAD is best in class. At the heart of the system, we have a rotary valve surrounded by 30 columns filled with a material. We pass the brine through those columns using the valve to map the flows very precisely, and the material in the valves, and the material in the columns, I should say, absorbs the lithium and rejects all the impurities. And so by doing this in a continuous way, we can process the lithium out of the brine and return the brine to its original source, the reservoir from which it came. We've been getting over 90% recoveries using this technology.
Sam, can you pull the mic a little closer?
Oh.
Yeah, and if you could wrap up on the technology now, and we'll get into
Salton Sea.
spot.
It's Salton Sea.
We can get into that in
the Q&A. Speak of the devil. So it's in Southern California, Salton Sea. We're using Iliad, and we will be building the world's first ever lithium from geothermal brine extraction facility. We've partnered with the Hudson Ranch Geothermal Power Station, where we've been testing and piloting our technology over the last 7+ years. We've extracted lithium from the brine there in a way which allows the depleted brine to be returned to the geothermal reservoir, and there it gets reheated and recharged over time. We call this Project Atlas. We do hope, as Janet said, that this will be the first of many, many plants on the Salton Sea. It'll produce 20,000 tonnes per year of battery quality lithium hydroxide monohydrate, and that's enough to power about 500,000 electric vehicles. We've been through an exhaustive development process at Salton Sea. The project is fully permitted through California's CEQA process. We are shovel ready. We just need to find $1 billion, which is about what one of these projects will cost. Once we've done so, we plan to start construction later this year. 2 years of construction should see our first lithium deliveries in 2026, maybe 2027.
I think you're
going to
call there. Thank you so much. Kristen, you want to?
Sure. Is this better?
Yes.
Hi, my name is Vincent Torres. The special project manager with Comité Cívico del Valle, a leading environmental justice organization in California, based in Southern California. Our headquarters are actually a couple minutes away from Salton Sea in Raleigh, the city in Imperial County. Our work as environmental justice advocates in an organization has centered around really solving a lot of the injustices that Imperial Valley has had for decades. It's an area that was essentially taken over by pioneers, which were rich families that came across to the West Coast, took a lot of land, established big family farms, now corporate farms, which has led to issues at the Salton Sea. So the Salton Sea is an accidental plate north of Imperial, in the north end of Imperial County, which has had decades of pesticide and metal runoffs. It's also has runoff from industry in Mexico because it flows through the international water, which is called the river. Our work in Lithium Valley, as we've been called now for a little over 2 years, revolves around making sure that the community is taken care of. It's been an under-resourced community. So when the Lithium Valley Commission was established, we were reached out to apply for a member of our organization to join. We helped our director apply, he became a commissioner, and he was integral into making sure that the disadvantaged communities were considered in the recommendations that were going to be put together by this commission. The commission did outline some recommendations in their Lithium Valley report, which they submitted to the legislature late last year. And in that report, we were glad to see that some of these recommendations included the concerns that we have, which is a health impact assessment, something that isn't done in developments like this, which was around $400,000 that was set aside, and Imperial County just awarded that to San Diego State University earlier this year, and they're going to be getting started on that. As part of that work as well, one of the recommendations is to develop a special economic zone, and that's a bill that's right now in the California legislature. It's been heard because Imperial County is kind of like the stepchild to San Diego, because we're just east of that, and so we've never had those resources. So now that lithium is coming into play, it is about what can that do for us, right? We don't just want to be an extracted part of the community, but we also want to flourish from this. Gavin Newsom, California governor, has called Lithium Valley the Saudi Arabia of California. Not a great analogy. Not great. And it's another one of those gaffes that happen, for politicians. But he has at least tried to make an effort through his administration and through his mandates for his staff to work on with the community. We've been invited, not just as an organization, but as community members, to participate a lot in the process. It's how we created the lithium excise tax, which puts 80% of the lithium tax that's going to be taken out of Lithium Valley back into Imperial County. And right now, one of our biggest fights as advocates is making sure that that money goes to community investments, not, you know, just into the pockets of local government, where they can create more jobs, better offices. No, this money has to go back to address public health issues, environmental issues, and provide opportunities for our community members to actually get trained and work in these careers in the lithium extraction field. We saw before that with solar, essentially, thousands of people were trained. They got these certificates for 2 years of work, and now thousands of people are on jobs. They're all working in something else. So we got to train them up and upskill them to take these opportunities that are going to come down. And our role is really to bring community to the table, to be part of that, while also informing. One of our biggest projects right now is making sure that, one, people can access EVs. How can we be the home of the material that's going to provide EVs to the U.S. community of the world, and then we can have access to them? So we're not only doing that through the state programs that provide incentives and rebates, but we're also building the infrastructure so that people can use EVs. So we have we did our first EV charger at our office, and we get dozens of people coming to charge every week. Right? And that's just, you know, a little bit of what we're doing.
Thank you both very much. We've been told that our audio is being piped into the room next door for a different camera.
Yeah, I was just going to come and ask if it's okay if we go mic-less for this room.
Can't hear them?
Can't hear them. It'd be very hard to hear.
Okay. How about we just do the wireless microphone? Is that okay?
Sure. We can pass it back and forth. Okay.
Will it still be recorded then?
You're recording on this thing. So.
I can't hear it.
Are we good to go?
We're figuring that out, so.
Okay. We're going to press on because we have an hour to solve the world's problems. Actually, 58 minutes. Okay, so both of you answered some of my questions right off the bat. So I'm going to try to follow up with some specifics. Did you want to do those first? I'm so sorry. We're going to introduce our other two panelists first.
Deep sea mining has been a fascination of mine as a journalist for the last few years because it's an industry that can fundamentally change the relationship that we humans have with the planet. It's also an industry that's at a major turning point right now. The idea of extracting minerals from the bottom of the ocean is not a new one. It's about a century old. But for most of that time, it's really been more of a science fiction than reality. Famously, during the Cold War, the CIA used deep sea mining as a cover story, basically as an alibi to, in fact, go to the middle of the Pacific Ocean and secretly recover a Soviet submarine that had sank there. But there's never been an actual commercial mining operation in the deep sea. But that could change in the next few years. So just briefly some context on how deep sea mining is regulated, at least in the high seas or international waters. Back in the 1990s, the United Nations chartered this group called the International Seabed Authority, the ISA. And the ISA manages the seabed beneath the high seas, and that's a big job because the high seas cover nearly half the planet. 167 member countries make up the International Seabed Authority, and together they've been drafting a mining code, which is basically a rule book, the regulations that a mining company would have to follow if they do, in fact, go out and start mining in the ocean. Those regulations, which cover financial and environmental aspects, they're still in draft form. They're still kind of being completed, not yet finalized. But the Pacific Island Nation of Nauru has announced that it intends to apply for a commercial mining permit in international waters later this year, even without those regulations finalized. And Nauru is partnering in this mining venture with the metals company, whose chief sustainability officer is here today, so we will have a chance to hear much more about this project. So there's a lot happening in the world of seabed mining right now. The stakes are high, as we will hear from our panelists. We have Dr. Douglas McCauley, professor of marine biology at UC Santa Barbara, and Erica Ocampo, chief sustainability officer with the metals company. So let's start with you, Erica.
Hello, everybody. I'm Erica Ocampo. I'm a chemical engineer. We have heard that this energy transition is going to come with a...
Can everybody hear?
Yep.
Okay. Sorry.
Okay. So the energy transition is going to come with a large demand of metals and of
unfortunately, this demand cannot be supplied by recycling alone for at least the next 30 or so years. This means that these metals then are going to have to come from somewhere, mined from somewhere. And today, some metals like nickel and cobalt come from the most biodiverse, nature-rich regions in the world, such as Indonesia and the DRC. And this supply chain today is being controlled by China. So what the metals company is looking to do is to provide an alternative to supply these metals from a place in international waters called the Clarion-Clipperton Zone, far away from any human settlement. The CCZ in Yucatan map is west of Mexico, southeast of Hawaii. It's equivalent to 1.2% of the entire ocean, and 43% of it is already set apart for conservation. And when you are in the CCZ, if you go 4,000 to 6,000 meters deep, you will find polymetallic nodules. Polymetallic nodules are, you know, potato-sized rocks. They contain four metals in one rock: nickel, cobalt, copper, and manganese. Because they sit unattached without overburden to remove, this means that they can be collected without digging, drinking, grinding, or blasting. And those are some of the qualities that makes these resources quite attractive. So this is an alternative of a scale that can provide a secure supply of these metals. And for you to have a sense of the scales of this resource in the CCZ, it is estimated to contain much bigger resources than the entire global terrestrial resources of nickel, cobalt, and manganese. In fact, 22% of the contracts that the metals company has can electrify the entire US passenger car fleet. I think as today we talk about deep sea mining, I really urge us to understand a very important distinction, that just like in terrestrial mining, there are different types of mineral resources in the ocean that have different metals, that are sitting at different depths in different ecosystems that require different mining technologies to extract them. And that's perhaps why polymetallic nodules has one of the main three mineral resources found on the seafloor is being the most attractive for most people. One, have really high ore grades. In the CCZ, they are finding large amounts of those ones. And the extraction of these metals is one of the lowest impactful ones because you don't have to dig into the seafloor. So I leave it there.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to use a few of my precious seconds to say thank you first on a different level, because I don't always get a chance to be in a room with a room full of environmental journalists. So this is a conversation embedded, of course, in a larger conversation about a climate crisis. Scientists, that's my world, we tend to think that we can solve everything and we can solve the climate crisis. We can't. Yeah, I wish we could. But if there was a group, we have a role to play. If there was a group that was going to figure this all out and remove things faster, it would be the folks here in the audience. So thank you for all the work you're doing. On the seabed mining front, I want to come and thank you for making some space for science to share a message from the scientific community, which is that 750 scientists have signed on to a statement that calls for a moratorium or a pause on seabed mining. Now, probably many of you work with scientists, I'm sure, almost daily, and so you have probably a better sense than even I do that getting seven scientists to agree on any one thing is near impossibility. 750 scientists signing on to a common statement is the only precedent I've seen is in the climate crisis space where we align with that kind of consensus. I want to maybe share three points from that statement and bring them into the conversation today about the risks of seabed mining that some scientists have said would be the biggest environmental, could potentially have the biggest environmental impact of any extractive activity we've had yet on the planet. The three points from that statement. The first is potential for destruction of biodiversity in these deep ocean spaces. So Erica said there are different kinds of mining out there. I'll cover polymetallic nodules, but other types as well. One form of mining was about mining on sea mounts, undersea mountains. These are incredibly biodiverse spaces. You can imagine a mountain rising to the ocean, cloud of rainbow-colored endemic fishes on top of these mountains. Some that are found nowhere else on the planet. Some that are found in no other mountains. mountaintops, gold corals on the top of these mountains. There is the old as pyramids, and again, the effectively underwater equivalent of mountaintop mining in that space. Polymetallic nodules, an equally biodiverse space rich with endemic many undiscovered species that live in that same ecosystem. I'll choose one flagship species, a octopus. I'm fond of octopus, called the Dumbo octopus, or Casper octopus. There's another Dumbo octopus out there in the same ecosystem. Casper octopus, because it's this super cute, opaque, sort of white octopus, lays its eggs on these polymetallic nodules. The deep ocean in this same space that we're talking about, the CCC, is remarkable and remarkably unique because of the diversity that I mentioned, but also its fragility. Scientists, when I was 10 years old, created a simulation experiment to try to get a sense of what the impacts of deep sea mining would have on the deep ocean off the coast of Peru. They've revisited that site every 10 years or about that frequency to get a sense of what in this small-scale experiment are the repercussions from things from bacteria to fishes. And in that same area, just to give you a sense of the lack of resiliency, the heightened degree of fragility, they've seen virtually no recovery for many different axes from bacteria to fishes. That's not something we see on any other part of the planet, which is just because of the very special physical and biological characteristics of life at the bottom of the sea. Another point in my list here is just the impacts that seabed mining could have on fisheries. The thing that really keeps me and many of my colleagues in the ocean science community up at night is the plumes that would be generated from seabed mining. When they put mining waste into, when it's ejected overboard into the ocean, these midwater plumes can grow to kilometers or more in size and last for days, weeks, or potentially months, depending on some of the dynamics of that effluent. These wastewater plumes are put right on top of some of the world's most productive fisheries. They do have toxins in them. Those toxins could enter these food webs, go into some of these fisheries, notably tuna fisheries, and then into our own markets. This is to say nothing also about the impacts of the plumes themselves in terms of the high sediment concentrations and smothering these food webs and reducing the productivity of the fisheries. Last point, which I'll wrap up with, is the potential impacts on climate. So these deep ocean and climate carbon stores in the CCC are some of the world's most ancient and secure carbon sources. A great amount of uncertainty and concern about what happens when you remobilize the carbon in that vault and put it back into the ocean, which has been our biggest ally thus far in sequestering carbon.
Thank you all. Really interesting. I'll kick it off with a question for Sam, just to set the stage a little more, although Christian did a great job. Imperial County is, depending on the year, the poorest county per capita, or the second poorest county per capita in California, which is a big state. And folks in the North End, as it's known, are among the poorest in Imperial County. So you have a real division of labor, of capital. In terms of very wealthy large farmers, and then a mostly Latino population that is living at a very low income level. And many outsiders have come to town, have come to Imperial. It's really a question for both of you, actually, saying, guess what, Imperial? We're going to make things better. The Obama administration, solar, they promised that these North End communities were going to be completely revitalized. There's going to be huge growth, huge jobs. A lot of big solar transmission lines are now strung through Imperial County, but those jobs didn't materialize. The dollars aren't coming in. There's a few, quote, special benefits that come to the county, but not a lot for the communities. A big prison built in one of these North End communities. They said all the prison guards are going to live right there, and it was going to help the local economy. They don't. They commute from fairly far away. So I'm wondering, for both of you, if you can comment on how many jobs could really be brought by your company and by the related industries, researchers, all of it. how many dollars potentially, and if you both see that promise being realized this time, or it's still an unknown in terms of whether it's really going to help. A prime example of a rural area in the United States that, as Christian said, has been a bit of a stepchild.
Thanks for the question. I mean, I would start by saying we don't see ourselves as an outside company coming into the valley. Energy Source Minerals grew out of Energy Source, and Energy Source was the company that built and developed the Hudson Marsh Power Station to which the project will be attached. That was built, you know, over 10 years ago now, and we have a long history of partnership with the valley. John Featherstone, one of the key members of the team who helped build that station, developed the technology that allows geothermal to work on the Salton Sea, or on the Salton Sea Reservoir, sorry, it's not attached to the sea itself. And, you know, has been there since the 70s and 80s. So we've got a very long history, and we would say partnership with local communities. We've learned through that experience that, you know, we will predominantly look to the local communities for our staff at the project sites. As Christian was saying, it's a pretty harsh environment up there, and it's the locals who have the sticking power to deal with the summer heat that you get in that location. So, you know, we've learned, you know, and are very clear about the kind of benefits that we can bring. The project itself, and remember this is hopefully stage one, we think we'll bring about 220 total jobs to the area, 70 direct jobs on the project itself through operators and technicians and etc. And then obviously support roles of transport and other around the side of the project. So that itself is meaningful. We are working with local educational institutes to make sure that the STEM programs are in place so that when the project comes online, you know, we have young folk in the area who are ready to move into those kinds of jobs. There are a lot of numbers thrown around, and there's a handout here which speaks to some of them, but significant level tax revenues, you know, $18 million per year in payroll, you know, $24 million a year on local taxes, and hundreds of millions of dollars over the life of the project back to the local community. So we're convinced that the economic benefits of a project like Atlas will be shared with the local community. Is it going to happen this time? I mean, yes, that's been said before, but you know, we are developing new technology, and as I said before, we've just got to find $1 billion that we need.
And this is from my experience with the other geothermal players, direct lithium extraction industries there. The same language has been used by all of them. They want to train local, they want to hire local, and they highlight the ones that already work there as part of the local workforce. We're a border community. We're right on the border with Mexico. The capital of Atlas, one in Mexicali, over a million people. That has dozens of universities, a lot of them really high grade technical schools, for engineering and the like, and a lot of these companies are hiring, you know, semi-local, right? Like, they're right there on the border. We consider ourselves more than just the Imperial Valley. We're also, like, part of the whole region. And Mexicali is part of us, right? But everybody commutes a lot of the times across the border. But going back to this, to the jobs, what we've seen is that, yes, it are promises. It goes back to solar industry. But we're already seeing that some of these companies are not starting with local. Some of them are bringing in engineers from other projects or from other firms internationally to work for a year, 6 months, 18 months on these separate contracts to do some of the work. And we understand that expertise isn't there locally yet. But that's the reason we fought with the California legislature to get $80 million for a STEM center to be built in Imperial County. And that's going to be built over the next couple of years as well. But we're also working with organized labor because we understand that there's going to be a lot of construction, a lot of maintenance and operations that are going to happen. And we want these good careers to be there. One of the companies and it's a competitor, so which is CTR, Control Thermal Resources, plans to have organized labor agreements, but that's only with one union out of many that are going to be taking professions to actually operate and maintain and establish these industries. So it's not that I don't think it'll happen. I think it's just a big fight to get to it, to make sure that it is a good investment in the community and we're not just, again, extracted. Because a lot of the power that comes from solar, it doesn't even stay in Imperial County. It goes out. And, you know, some companies are even took advantage of the fact that we're on the border to develop plants across the border so they could bypass a lot of the California protections. And yet those lines run across our county, across our lands, across a lot of the agriculture that pisses off farmers, really. Like, the fact that they're losing the landscape that they've done for generations because these industries are coming in, but they're not, you know, seeing the investment come back.
Thank you both. I'm just going to do one more question on the lithium side to keep things rolling. So I want to make sure everybody has the picture here really quickly, too, in terms of the process. So basically, from this hot boiling brine, you pump it up and it's flashed into steam. And so you do have, yes, I think it's up to 13 now, existing power plants that are producing a cleaner form of power. It might be a dozen, you guys would know better. But anyway, and now for decades, they pumped the waste back underground, which included lithium that was worth pennies on the dollar until recently, and then last year prices climbed as high as $80,000 a finished ton, I think. So just to give you a sense of the changing landscape there, but there are environmental, there are emissions from these plants, particularly the older ones. The Energy Source one is newer, but Berkshire Hathaway has bought the older plants, and there are building blocks for smog that are emitted from some of those older plants in a region that already has heavy air pollution from pesticides from the drying out salt and sea. You're also going to be using Colorado River water for your project if you get the funding. So there are some environmental considerations. On the other hand, there are a lot of reduced emissions. So I just wanted to give both of you an opportunity to comment on, is this just a necessary trade-off? Are you taking steps to reduce what are some of the real environmental resource needs there? I guess that's about it. Thanks.
Well, from our experience over the last couple of years in dealing with Energy Source, Control the Resources, for Hathaway, and a lot of outside interests that have a lot of investment in this industry, is that, you know, it's cleaner, but it's not clean in general, right? Like, it's not zero, net zero. It's just cleaner methods to get to where we need to go. In California, there's a lot of big goals that we need to meet in the next probably 20 years to get to zero emissions, whether it's vehicles, freight, and everything else. But I think that's also where our role has come a lot into play, because we got the health impact assessment included into the programmatic environmental inquiry process that the county's going, who's going to have jurisdiction over these projects. We also got a seat at the table to inform how that programmatic EIR process is happening. We created working groups within that. We're now starting community engagement on that process so that everybody that lives in these communities that's already been affected by the Salton Sea is an environmental disaster that scientists in 1986 put a report out, then told the federal government, and nothing's been done so far, right? Like, all the very insignificant tokens of money has been dedicated to. So now is the opportunity to, like, okay, something is going to come out of this. The money has to go back specifically to address these environmental concerns. And when it comes to water, that's also one of the big issues. A report that this last year put together by one of the universities, the recommendation was that you can't bring water back into the Salton Sea. It's not feasible. So we have to address that. We know the extraction is going to require water in some way. We know the Salton Sea is drying out, and the more it dries out, the more it impacts everybody. And that's going to include a lot of workers at these plants, because they're adjacent to the Salton Sea. They're maybe 10 minutes away from the Salton Sea, and you can see it from Hudson Ranch if you're out there. So, you know, we have to simultaneously work on creating a system that is not going to cause more damage while also addressing the damages that are already there.
I think you're going to.
Yeah, and that balance is hard.
Thank you.
Thanks, Christian. One point I put, Mike, is there's no connection between the geothermal power stations and the actual surface Salton Sea itself. We don't take water from the Salton Sea. The reservoir that we access is several miles underground and is not connected in any way. And as you say, you know, we do take water from the Colorado River Sea as part of our operations. Project Atlas will be the most environmentally friendly lithium project anywhere in the world. So, you know, yes, it is an industrial process. We do need some water, but actually not that much. And we have spent a lot of time looking through every part of the process to make sure that we're using it as efficiently as we possibly can. We recycle streams wherever we can. We purify, and it gets used over and over. So some water does come in from the Colorado scheme, and that gets used to help wash the lithium out of the tanks. Other projects would use acid or base to do that. The spent brine then goes down back into the reservoir where it recharges and reheats over time. So, I would say we do have to make decisions about where we get our lithium from. The Salton Sea is a great resource. There are existing water allocations for industrial use. Project Atlas will take a small part of one of those, and it's also a lot less than goes on to any of the farms in the area. So I think we feel pretty good about our water footprint at Atlas and everywhere else that we're looking.
Thank you both so much.
All right, so I just have a couple questions for the deep sea mining folks before we open it up to the audience. My first question for Erica is about the extraction technology. So the Metals Company proposes to use a machine that is often described as similar to a vacuum cleaner. It would go back and forth on the seabed, suck up the nodules as well as some of the surrounding sediment. And this would cause some of the impacts that Doug spoke about, including destruction of some of the seabed habitat, sediment plumes in the water. My question is, how do you determine that this is the right technology when there are other ideas out there, like autonomous vehicles that would hover above the surface and pluck up these nodules? How do you determine which technology is right?
Well, that's a challenging question in terms of what is the goal, right? And when you start looking at technology development and innovation, you always start with a baseline of proven technology. And that is going to definitely drive innovation. And this one that you mentioned as well, picking up nodules, is one of many that I'm sure will come after this one. So the reason why we choose this technology is because it uses the Coanda effect. So while it's considered like a vacuum cleaner in theory, it's really applying parallel to the seabed water jets that lift the nodules that then are sucked into this vacuum cleaner collection vehicle. And what happens with the sediment on the floor, we are impacting about the 5 to 10 top centimeters of the seafloor, and then a lot of that sediment, 95% goes on the back of the collector vehicle in the seafloor, and 5% come with the collector nodules and the water that is lifting the nodules. On top of the vessel, the waters, and you return the water and that 5% of sediment to a return pipe that we are analyzing what is the best depth to return it. So for us, this one seems that the modeling that we have, the certainty for us to be able to tweak it to a point where we can limit the amount of sediment, the amount of push down onto the sea floor, being able to manage the noise and those kind of things is something that we feel comfortable about because we know this technology. But that does not mean that other technologies won't come to play to help us to continue to
challenges, but I would just say that it's important to realize that some of the scientific concerns that I registered before the ancient carbon store, that is the layer that is under discussion that's being mined. That is the carbon-rich store. I would say there are other impacts that I didn't mention. Drew attention to the issue of noise, for example. Now, remember, this extraction is happening kilometers deep at the bottom of the ocean. So you have a riser pipe that goes to the mining mothership, which some ocean scientists estimate that the rattling of these nodules that are going up this pipe is the loudest sound we've ever made in the ocean. We've made some unfortunately loud sounds in the ocean, which can be incredibly disruptive for all kinds of biodiversity and space, most notably marine mammals and other, and cetaceans and other marine mammals. Yeah. So I would say, if it was as clinical as it perhaps sounds on the handout sheet, you would not have 750 scientists that signed on a consensus statement say that we need to take pause.
Yeah, go back. 1 minute, and then we're going to open up.
And we love to show you, because we actually have field data of our collector test that happened last year, where we actually collected noise data. And we also have 1 to 3 years of data collected through moorings and through hydrophones that are tracing kind of those vocalization of mammals to figure out what's happening underwater. So right now we're working with world experts such as HR, what's called Waterford, and the Scottish Society of Marine Science, to have this sound model specifically for that. So now with the field data, they're able to validate that, then that's going to help us. And also when there is all, because I think we tend to say the scientist, and the scientist is not an homogeneous group, right? We also have hundreds of scientists working on this, not necessarily pro or against, they are just trying to understand with us the pros and cons on the different area of expertise they have. So they are not monolithic, there is a group of them, there are some of them that actually get to do research based on field data instead of just ideas of what it could be. And so that's what is happening today. Thankfully, we want to work with as many scientists as they can, right? Like, and that's what we're doing, because we don't have that set of expertise that is very niche and unique when we start talking about what we've seen.
Sorry, 10 seconds.
10 seconds. You're a sophisticated audience. My only, as I'm saying something that's already obvious, please read the funding disclosures of the science that you read to see who is actually paying for that science.
All right, well, thank you. We are going to open up to the audience now for questions for any of our panelists. Just a quick reminder, journalists have priority for asking questions, and before your question, just introduce yourself, name, and affiliation.
Should I take a mic or just speak?
Just speak.
Try speaking.
I'll project. David Ferris with E&E News. I lead our electric vehicle coverage. And my question's for you, Doug. The ocean floor is obviously a really hard place to study. And given, is there any realistic scenario where we're going to know enough about the environmental impacts for nodules to be a meaningful part of supplying our programs?
That's a great question. It's a hard place to study. It's a hard place to monitor, too, which maybe is part of this conversation. So I think of the mines that at least I saw as we're flying in and landing in Boise, right? Mining on land, almost 1,000-year enterprise, maybe a 50-year exercise in trying to make that environmentally sustainable. It's very hard to actually do the kind of monitoring as well as environmental impact work and assessment and cleanup in that context where we can send scientists directly into that area to see what the impacts are as the material is live and to clean up those impacts. And is, as you say, immensely harder when you're working thousands of miles away from shore, kilometers deep. It's harder to manage that impact. I mean, the metals company has an immensely difficult job when you put a tailings pile down next to a mine on land, it stays put there. When you put it into the ocean, it does not stay put. Moves into these ecosystems and across borders. So I suppose from a biological standpoint, It's a harder place, which is a source of concern for us to study the impacts. More importantly, or equally important, to monitor the impacts if this was to go ahead. And it's certainly a very open question, which is why I'm glad everyone was paying attention to it, because commercial mining, as Dan pointed out, has not yet been authorized. So there are many sources of complexity from the science and also from the compliance monitoring standpoint that come from the fact that we're doing this one of the most difficult to operate places in the planet.
Hi, I'm Cheryl Hoag. I'm an independent journalist in Washington, D.C. And my question is for Sam, and it's about your lithium sorption and desorption. Does that process use energy? Can it use organic solvents? And what is the material that it is sorbed to? Is it a type of PFAS or a plastic, or what is that?
You found me out. I didn't warn you, I wasn't an engineer.
We don't use solvents in the EPA process itself, and that's one of the differentiating factors between what we offer and what some other DLE technologies will require. And so we use water to flush the lithium out of the sorbent. We charge it with a little bit of lithium itself to help it attract the lithium out of the sorbent, but it's water. And that really is, that's it. I can't speak to the manufacturing of the sorbent itself. It's proprietary and one of the things that we hold very close to our chest and be way out of my wheelhouse if I try to. So,
yes, you, sir.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, my name is David Halvard, author, writer, co-host of the Rising Tide Ocean podcast. Did my first article on deep sea mining in 1977, so some ideas keep cycling through. I guess my question is for Erica. I interviewed Don Walsh, who was the first man to go to the deepest part of the ocean. He's very skeptical. I interviewed Monica Medina, who's the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Oceans and Science. She said that deep sea mining is not ready for prime time. So I'm curious, and a number of other nations are not calling for moratorium. France is now calling for ban, New Zealand, the Pacific. For transnational corporations like Google and even car companies like Volkswagen, BMW say they don't want deep sea minerals. So I guess my question is, where is all this opposition coming from? Well, we know where it's coming from, but why do you think all this opposition, all this call for moratorium is there? And what's the response when it's going from not just NGOs, but nation states and corporations?
That's a good question. And honestly, we wish there was not that hard of an opposition knowing where the minerals come today, right? Because we're looking at planetary systems approach. And the truth is that these either come from here or there, it's going to have an impact because every extractive industry has an impact. So the real question we pose back is, how big of what the magnitude of the impact are we willing to pay as a society? And that's why we're proposing these. When you talk about governments coming forward with these moratoriums, we understand that there are 12 out of 167 member nations, right? So either by number of nations or number of population representing those nations is not representing the world as an opposition. They tend to be very loud voices in the NGO community, and honestly, I do identify with them. I am concerned about the state of the world. I am concerned of where this is coming. I am concerned of how we're going to get it. But the reality of it is that difficult decisions lie ahead. We understand, you know, that the role of a scientist is to have absolute scientific certainty, while the role of a contractor would be to know enough to manage risks. And that's why, with the information we have collected for the last 10 years, the environmental management system, and the data management system, and all the tools that we are taking to play a role in this development, we feel confident that we can assess the risks, manage them, and continue to improve on those.
Just a quick reminder, panelists, please hold the mic close to your mouth so we can all hear you.
Thank you.
question on the on the governance, and this is the space of the high seas that at least I'll answer your question to, because there can be mining proposed within national waters, which is a domestic conversation. But in the high seas, there is, as Dan mentioned before, the International Seabed Authority, and actually what Erica was just mentioning, this growing opposition for the members that member states that attend is the ISA, International Seabed Authority, which is to decide whether or not we begin mining. It's been, again, from the scientific point of view, which uses as a great hazard for ocean health, very encouraging to see the amount of awareness and receptivity to science grow there in the ISA. It's a very live conversation, I suppose, for folks that are watching and reporting on this, as you already know well, but next session of the International Seabed Authority this summer, there are going to be some very important decisions that are made this summer and in the intervening year. As Dan said, there's been a strong push by industry that say, even if you do not pass your regulation, and I think this is fair to say for the metals company, we're going to go and do it anyway, which you can only imagine how concerning that is to have a structure that's supposed to take into consideration all nations' point of views as well as science and potentially have an opportunity to disregard that process, that important due process.
Can we just let you respond?
Yeah, I want to respond. So just as a reminder, the Pacific Island Nation of Nauru, which is partnering with the metals company, has said it intends to apply for a license to mine this summer, to apply this summer, despite the absence of regulations.
So you're referring to the two-year rule. So 2 years ago, Nauru, which is our sponsor in the state, a company cannot access the seafloor. It has to be through a nation state, as I was saying. They said, we have a two-year rule, which means you have to complete the regulations. If not, we can actually submit an application. Nauru has not said that we're not going to submit an application without regulations. However, they are excited with the progress that has been done for the ISA to complete actually the regulations this year. And so we're saying we are preparing to have the most comprehensive environmental impact statement, which is part of our proposed application, to be submitted this year. And then they have to review it, and it takes over a year to get that kind of review and approval. Resource in international waters is quite unique, and if you look at the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, they deem resources in international waters common heritage of humankind, which means that any person in this room is an actual stakeholder of this project, which makes it really challenging for us to reach out to the world, but that's definitely one of the first of its kind where we have social impact assessment. We contracted PRISMA, which is an expert in doing social impact assessments, where we get the consultation from stakeholders across the world. So they go to different nations, not just the sponsoring state nations in the Pacific Islands, which are perhaps the ones that we connect more one-to-one because we are, you know, they are our sponsor. So you think about Nauru, you think about the Kingdom of Tonga, and we do have programs in place in those communities, not only to explain and talk about it, because we are not just talking to the government, as you mentioned, but also to have programs in place that are going to benefit those communities as we go. The concern about having an impact from these operations outside mostly comes from the concern of plumes coming from these operations. We have models, and we have other scientists, we have right now DHI and MIT, who have released some reports on the big water plumes and the benthic plumes that show that the plumes are not going to transverse kilometers, thousands of kilometers across. Suffocating fisheries has some concerns of some scientists are posed. So in terms of impact to those communities, that part of the fisheries part is not really a tangible concern regarding those results. However, we understand that the ocean, by expansion is part of the heritage of Pacific Islanders. So that to us is one of the conversations we most have to understand and honor the understanding of the sea.
Could you maybe speak up as loud as you possibly can?
I'm Najifa, I'm a graduate journalism student at the University of Montana. So my question is for Douglas. I think you touched on this a bit in the previous question, that the mining companies might as well just do it anyway, scientists agree or not. But I just wanted to ask you, like, is there any, you know, eco-friendly or new technology or sustainable approach that could convince you or your fellow scientists to change your mind on this topic?
Question was, is there any kind of new technology that might change Doug's mind on this?
It's a great question. I'm going to just quickly respond to the conversation about stakeholders, only to say, to try to give some voice or space for indigenous communities in the Pacific, which went to the ISA, and there were some dozen or so representatives that shared their message. If you're interested, please look up their message, because it's an important one and it deserves a piece of the conversation. So scientists, in addition to never being always infighting, never agreeing, except on a select number of issues, also change their mind. And which is to say, a good scientist, I hope maybe I'm in that category, at least in terms of allowing myself to be changeable, is that we look at a landscape and a changing planet of changing data and then update our understanding every new moment that there is new data. If there was data that came out tomorrow that told me that fossil fuel emissions did not cause climate change, I would not be against fossil fuel emissions. Perhaps that's a good analogy. If there's information that comes up tomorrow, aside from the literally hundreds of peer-reviewed, non-industry-funded research reports that show that there are high risks, the categories I just mentioned, that would somehow suggest that this is not going to be an impact, but it could be done somehow, I don't know, magically without those impacts, that would change my mind.
Anybody over there?
Sherry Geiger, independent journalist from Phoenix. I have a question regarding the Lithium Valley Commission. You were talking about the impact of this mining on your community. Doesn't this require oversight by State California and local legislators? Isn't that really the solution to the problem? I just see that happening on the state level where I come from. Phoenix issued medallions to help impoverished and indigenous people start marijuana businesses, and they were pretty much all taken over by corporations. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
I'm not sure if everybody heard it. Just to summarize really quickly, is there state and other oversight of this lithium? It's actually not mining, it's extraction, but yes, this industry in this area, perhaps measures that would include, as I understand the question, having ultra-local based entities doing this work as well through some sort of permitting.
Well, yeah, isn't it up to government to really oversee these programs?
So yes, the state is involved, the state of California, whether that's through the permitting process, because there is a standard by when a geothermal facility hits a certain power output, and it is at this energy commission's level. But Imperial County, where Lithium Valley sits, did request last year that, you know, they have decision-making power on power plants above the local minimum standard, as we said. But the state is involved. Right now, you know, we're like the pretty girl at the dance. That we have attention from the federal government, the state government, and international bodies as well, looking at it. And the state is trying to make a concerted effort to make sure that the local community informs a lot of these decisions that happen that are going to affect a lot of the long-term situations. And the commission was part one that was put together. That was put together in a bill by our assembly member that represents the Eastern Coachella Valley and Imperial Valley, which is where Lithium Valley sits in Peru. But Eastern Coachella, Puerto Rosa County, a big transportation hub is also getting affected. So we're not, the state is also looking at like what other agencies we have to bring in to make sure that we have a plan in place that kind of makes sense. so that when workforce development is coming in, the Department of Labor is coming in on training programs, the Energy Commission on the geothermal side of, for power generation, the environmental agencies have gotten involved, the Air Resources Board because of the, their jurisdiction over mobile sources are looking at like, well, what's going to happen once this thing gets put in and out? You have poor communities are also looking out because right now the refinery of lithium isn't something that's being talked about. So would it be extracted, taken out, being brought back in? Because also manufacturing is going to happen. Battery manufacturing is set to also take place there. So what does that look like as well when the permitting for all of that has to happen? So, you know, then at the end of the life cycle, what happens to recycling? What regulations have to be put in place and what's oversight has to be put in there? And then as well, one of the bills that's currently in the legislature being discussed this year is also on the lithium excise tax, an oversight advisory committee being put together, but at the state level instead of at the local level. Historically, our local government hasn't done the best job at taking care of everybody. They've taken care of the 1%. So, you know, as from our perspective as environmental justice and from our Lithium Valley Community Coalition, which includes EJ, social justice, organized labor, and community leaders, we're supporting that bill because we know that sometimes this decision, that this oversight is going to have to be taken by the state, not at the local level where interests are already kind of putting conflicts in place.
I'm going to throw one more kind of big picture question in here with a little bit of time we've got left. But I am also curious, because funding is a big part of this, and we've got huge federal funds right now. Like, they're backing up the trucks to unload the infrastructure funding and the IRA funding. And so you mentioned $1 billion at the top. And I'm wondering what that $1 billion would go for you quickly. And then for all of you, I thought this graduate student's question was so good. If you're against this current technology that's being proposed, or even if you're in favor of it, it doesn't get us all the way there. So, I mean, what do you see, very briefly, as concrete solutions, you know, to slowing the rate of emissions being pumped into the atmosphere? If you're against deep sea mining, fair enough, but what are you seeing as a potential solution? So let's start at the very end, and if you can all keep it as tight as possible, I'm so sorry.
Do my best. I think the question is, where do we see DOE?
Well, what do you need $1 billion for? And are you going to be able to get any of that from the feds, from the current budget? Or is it...
Whoever's got it. Exactly. You know, like the federal government has got several programs in play, and we're working, you know, we'll work with the DOE through their advanced vehicle technology manufacturing fund. They've got a grant program that came under the Inflation Reduction Act. So they are definitely, as you said at the very start, interested in these supply chains and trying to find concrete ways that they can help support industry. Those things take time. They take a long time. There's a lot of education needs to take place, and there are a lot of companies, which you want, in the US, innovating in ways to provide solutions to the supply chain for critical minerals. I mean, you know, obviously we are talking very large infrastructure projects. Building a large processing facility like Project Atlas is just a very large undertaking. Development of these raw material projects can take 10 years. And that kind of speaks to the question of how fast we can transition, right? It's not just a question of finding the money. You know, if you look at the wider supply chain or the wider transition to EVs, you're talking over $1 trillion, maybe one and a half, over what period of time, who knows. But the money's only really one part of it. It takes time, and it takes innovation and a lot of effort. But you know, never underestimate the ability of the human race. And I think, you know, the US in particular to innovate and go through the things.
And I think the second question was about the science and whether there's other solutions, right?
Yes. What do you see as solutions?
Yeah. For the direct lithium extraction, I'm still waiting to see the Lawrence Berkeley Lab report. That I know that they have been working with all three companies that have base at the Salton Sea Geothermal Resource Area on what the final numbers are going to be. And I think based on that, how we can make a more informed decision. And that's why we wanted to include community engagement into the programmatic AI process so that when this report comes out, you know, the people that are there, the scientists, can explain what does this mean and what are the recommendations we should be making, what first guidance that should be created to kind of monitor this moving forward. But I do think like changing transportation is going to be one of the key things that we're going to have to do. Me being a lifelong member of a border community, I've been a roadside supporter. I see vehicles idle for hours. I've been in a car for hours. So we got to switch that up. We can't just have cars idling for 4 or 5 hours just so you can get to work, go to the doctor, all these things. And we see it both ways. You try to go to Mexico, you see cars idling for hours as well right now because, you know, port of entries are not very friendly and they're not very speedy. So changing transportation is going to have to be one way. Also, making other resources available. We have a huge array of solar in Imperial County, but it's on what used to be farmland. But we don't have solar on houses, on schools, on public spaces where it would make sense because we have the sun probably 90% of the year active, like very hot. So we should be tapping into those natural resources as well. Thank you.
I have a long list of Christmas requests. So if I have that much money, I would like to be able to ensure a processing plant for these metals in the U.S. so we don't have to depend from China for those ones. I would like more investment on technologies that will allow decarbonization of metallurgical processes, such as green hydrogen. Also more development on the shipping industry to decarbonize as well. I would love to see a federal regulation that stands for tracing of these minerals and recovery of these minerals to actually have a solid circular economy of these batteries, which are quite valuable. So that would be on the sense of the money. In terms of technologies, I think there's a lot of promising ones, but at the end of the day, as an engineer, my first step is efficiency, right? And how can we have a more efficient use of our vehicles and energy use? So that would be the first one. The second one would be like cultural shift. So for example, we want long range electric vehicles, which people use barely for long range, and we could use more effectively shorter range chemistries for cities, and then have the chemistries that require longer range for rural areas.
Starter IRA thought, which is just that the IRA is not a policy to move forward a fast-tracked green energy paradigm revolution. The IRA is a policy that's supposed to move forward a just and sustainable fast-tracked green energy paradigm revolution. So I do not see activities like seabed mining. Neither do 750 plus of my colleagues see it as meeting that sustainable definition. So I do not think, I think it's important to make that point. It's a candidate for IRA funding. There are many good things on the table. This is simply not one.
What would be some of those candidates?
Fair enough. I think this is something that we can invent our way out of. And in fact, I think this is something we are inventing our way out of, which is to say, as much as this conversation is predicated on us using lithium-ion batteries to do all of this electrification that we need, I want to be clear that I think we absolutely need and want to, but there are a whole host of new kinds of battery technologies that don't require us going to rainforests, that don't require us going to the bottom of the oceans to solve the planet by destroying parts of the planet that can't be the solution. So take LFP batteries, right? That don't require nickel or cobalt, which are the things that folks are seeking in the deep ocean principally. LFP batteries are not something that is a dream in a lab. Last year, Tesla, about half of the production included LFP batteries. Rivian has announced they're going to go entirely to LFP. Ford's building a $3.5 billion LFP production plant in the United States. So there is the technology that helps us get to electrification without mining the ocean, creating all of the challenges that we laid out and my colleagues have laid out before. And I think, again, not a pipe dream. And I'm aware that the metals company received a delisting notice yesterday from NASDAQ because of stock prices. I wish I could say that was because folks are listening to scientists. I think it's because they're paying attention to battery innovation and material, some of these trends for demand as it relates to some of this innovation.
All right, well, thanks everyone. It is lunchtime.
At
told you got to get to the ballroom right at noon if you want lunch, but we're the panelists will be around today, so come find us if you want to talk more.